Today we are going to continue our series called Life to the Full. And again, it's based on one of my favorite verses from John 10, verse 10. And Jesus, again, has been talking about sheep, people, us, and the shepherd himself. And he's been talking about how the sheep know the shepherd's voice, how the shepherd knows the sheep by name, how there have been threats, there have been others who have come and tried to harm and hurt and pull away. But Jesus says this in verse 10, "The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy, but I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." Life to the full. And so 2 weeks ago, we talked about the wedding in Cana from John chapter 2, where Jesus turns water into wine, his very first public miracle. And John, in his account, a little bit different than the other Gospels, John doesn't just explain what happened, but John explains what was meant behind what was happening as well. I challenged you that day to, if you are skeptical, if you have questions, if it's like, hey, I come to church and I hear about Jesus, but I just don't know. I challenged you with just the words that Philip shared with Nathaniel and his doubts about Jesus. Come and see. Continue to show up. Come and see. Come and see what Jesus can do in your life. And I challenged you at the end of that message, make a point to don't miss any celebrations this year when the church comes together. If you're traveling or on vacation, then find a place to worship, but don't miss any celebrations. Last week, we talked about Jesus' encounter with the Samaritan woman from John chapter 4. How Jesus knew his purpose in life. It was to draw people close to God. How it was to eventually save them from their sins. But in this encounter, he meets this woman. He begins dialoguing with her. He determines his approach in a very non-threatening way. And she gets to a point where she realizes who he is. That he is the Son of God. That he is the Messiah. The one they've been waiting for. And she in turn goes back to her town. And scripture is clear. John is clear in his account. He tells us that many Samaritans in her town believed because of her testimony. I challenged you last week to write down a name, someone that would be praying about, a name that God would put on your heart, on your mind, that you could be praying for, that you could be looking for opportunities to converse with them about spiritual things, people that are far from him, that you could have a component, you could have a part, a piece in helping give them life to the full. Today I want to talk to anyone who currently, everyone who perhaps in the past at some point or maybe right now has ever had doubts you can't reconcile or questions that have no answer, questions that seem to have no answer. What do you do when you have doubts in life? What do you do when you face questions that don't seem to have an answer, especially when it comes to God and Christianity? So I want to look at the story in John chapter 9. Again, if you are unfamiliar, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the fourth gospel in the New Testament. But before we get to that, I want to introduce you to this man. This man is Dr. Robert Adair. And Dr. Adair was born in 1959. He has a doctorate in nuclear physics, taught at Yale University starting in 1959. He's now, he chaired their physical sciences department for years, but he's now a professor with emeritus status there. He's one of the smartest men in the world. And you might wonder why he's holding a baseball. Well, much of his fame surrounding him has to do in the area of baseball. Specifically, how do you hit a major league fastball? What's the science behind it? He's written a book called The Physics of Baseball, first released in 1990, now on its third edition. I'm sure it's a great read if you enjoy that sort of thing, but I was just interested in his research. In 2000, he was discussing with a group of other of the smartest scientists in the world, and he summarized his research specifically on how to hit a 90-mile-per-hour fastball. So I want to show you a few graphics this morning to kind of explain that. And he found that when a pitcher releases the ball from their hand, and I know my pitcher here is still in the windup, but when a pitcher releases the baseball from his hand, moving 90 miles per hour, the time it takes to leave his hand and cross home plate is 400 milliseconds. 400 milliseconds. To put that in perspective, when you blink your eyes, that is 300 to 400 milliseconds, depending on how slow you blink. But less than half a second is what I'm getting at. So literally in the blink of an eye, a pitch is released from his hand and it crosses home plate. If you're a batter, it takes you 100 milliseconds to see the ball and pick up the speed of the ball, the location of the ball. Then it takes you another 100 milliseconds for your brain to process if you're going to swing or not. So 100 milliseconds to see the ball, another 100 milliseconds to decide, am I going to swing or not? So half the distance to the plate, 200 milliseconds to determine, am I going to swing or not? At that point, his research says it takes another 100 milliseconds to decide how you're going to swing. If you're going to swing, how you're going to swing, inside, outside, up, down, how you're going to swing at this pitch. The swing itself takes 150 milliseconds from the time your brain sends the signal to your legs, which is where it starts, 150 milliseconds to where the ball gets in the zone to actually hit it, for you to get the swing around. So you can do the math, 450 milliseconds. So as he's presenting his research to this group of scientists, smartest people in the world, he summarizes it with this statement. Hitting a 90-mile-per-hour fastball is clearly impossible. I mean, think about it. 400 milliseconds for the ball to cross the plate, 450 milliseconds for you to pick up the ball, decide, and then determine how to swing, and then actually to get the swing around. No one could ever hit a 90-mile-per-hour fastball. But we don't buy that, do we? Why don't we buy that? Well, we've seen it happen, right? In fact, I'll just ask this morning, I'm going to keep my hand down, but how many of you have hit a 90-mile-per-hour fastball? I know there are some of you in the room who have done so. Now, I was asked this before second service. Yeah, but have you been hit by a 90-mile-per-hour fastball? I'm sure that one hurts quite a bit. But some of you in the room have hit a 90-mile-per-hour fastball. Some of you could even say, I've seen a 100-mile-per-hour fastball hit before. I know it can take place. And yet I would ask, could you come up here and explain to me where Dr. Adair's research is flawed? There might be one or two people in the room that could do it, but I'm going to guess most of us could not come and explain where his research is flawed. And yes, we don't doubt it because we've seen it happen. Now, if you've seen a 100-mile-per-hour fastball hit, Dr. Adair, you can actually look this up on the Google. He says to hit a 100-mile-per-hour fastball, your odds are the same as putting on a blindfold and just taking a swing. That's what he says. So why don't we settle for that? Why don't we settle for the idea that it's clearly impossible to do so? It's because in most areas of life, we choose the undeniable over the unexplainable. In most areas of life, we choose the undeniable over the unexplainable. I would say, well, I have no idea how you can hit a 90-mile-per-hour fastball, but when it comes to the undeniable versus the unexplainable, I'm going to opt for the undeniable over the unexplainable. That's where I'm going to land. And we do that in all kinds of areas of life. I got my first cell phone back in 1999. Do you guys remember the Nokia brick phone, right? You could play Snake on that. Yeah, I had this phone. Dana and I had this phone when we were first married. And I didn't go into AT&T and say, hey, until you can explain to me how this phone works, I'm not going to use it. I just started using it because I needed a phone and it was convenient. It was undeniable. I saw it work. The last time you went to the doctor and you were in pain, or you were sick, and the doctor checked you out, and he prescribed some medication, you probably didn't stop and say, maybe one or two of you, but most of us didn't stop and say, hey, until you can explain to me how this medication works, exactly what it does inside of me, what it does to my body, I'm not going to take it. Some of you are thinking, I'm in pain. I'm sick. Give me the medicine. I just want to get better. Why? Because you either trusted the doctor, or you had seen how this medicine had worked in other places. We do that all the time. Now, each of us probably knows someone who just has to have an explanation for everything. It's that person that you ask, hey, what time is it? And they say, well, my watch says it's 11:06, but technically it's probably 11:07, and my watch is a little slow, and they get into all the finite details. And it's like, hey, I don't need to know all of that. I know how a watch works, or I know that it's off by a minute or two. I get that. Just tell me what time it is, especially if you're a leader and someone wants to get into all the nitty-gritty details or explanation of something. Let's get going. I got places to be, things to do. We've got projects to take care of. But we utilize this dynamic in most areas of life where we just accept the undeniable. We choose the undeniable over the unexplainable. But there's an area of life where we struggle with that. When it comes to God, when it comes to Christianity, for many of us, when it comes to God, we often focus on the unexplainable and lose sight of the undeniable. And some of you here this morning might say, until I get every single question, every single doubt answered about God, about Christianity. I'm not budging. And as a result, no explanation then becomes our rationale for rejection. Because I don't have an explanation, I'm going to reject Christianity. I'm going to reject God because I don't have an answer to all my questions. But we don't do that in every other area of life. And again, I'm not trying to discount the unexplainables. The unexplainables are important, but they're not the end all. Some of you might look at that and say, well, I can't reconcile with that. If there are unexplainables and I'm not reconciling those, then that just seems intellectually dishonest. But you need to understand, we utilize the same idea in many areas of our life. The last time that you planned to fly somewhere, did you stand outside of the airplane and look at the plane and say, until the pilot can explain to me how this tin can gets up in the air, I'm not boarding? To which if you did, all pilots would probably say, well, get in your car, get on a boat, because we're going without you. That's what would take place. We don't do that sort of thing. How many of you men are married in the room? Raise your hand. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Can you explain to me the inner workings of the mind of a woman? Because I'd really like to know. I made some progress. I've been married 19 years, made some progress, but I'd like to know. So why did you get married? Well, I know why you got married, but we'll talk about that next month in our marriage series. We do this in all kinds of areas of our life. Most of you drove here this morning in a car. And if we were to go out to the parking lot and open up the hood and I were to say, can you explain to me how this engine works? I know there's some of you in the room that could tell me exactly how it works. But most of us, the majority of us in the room would say, I don't really know how it works. But you got in your car this morning, you started it up and you drove here. You just trust in the undeniable over the unexplainable. Yeah, it got me here. Yes, but you can't explain it. You can't tell me exactly how it works. So we accept the undeniable over the unexplainable. Now, some of us in life, we struggle with this. But let me tell you, every single person who has come to faith in Christ, every single person who has become a Christian, in fact, has brought some questions into that. Every single person. They've not had, if you're not a Christian, you need to understand, every person that has become a follower of Jesus Christ has brought some questions into that. But something happened that was so personal, but was so undeniable, that they chose to put the undeniable over the unexplainable. John chapter 9, what I love about this passage is it explains very clearly what happens in our life when we hang on to the unexplainable over the undeniable and we stay there. Well, I'm going to keep pushing back. I'm going to keep standing on this. I'm not budging until I have all of my questions answered. So the story's clear on what happens when that takes place. John chapter 9, if you have your Bible with you, we're going to start in the first few verses, verses 1 and 2. As he, that's Jesus, as he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? So Jesus' disciples, I mean, they start right out of the gate here. They've struggled with one of these most unexplainable questions in history. And it stands around today as well. In fact, in their culture and in many cultures around the world, this question is asked all the time. Why do bad things happen to good people? Or why do bad things happen to innocent people? Here's a man born blind, and their assumption was, well, he must have done something wrong, or his parents or his grandparents must have done something wrong. That's their assumption. And so they're just asking Jesus, who did it? Who's to blame? Well, as he often does, Jesus was always taking our terrible assumptions about God and clarifying them. Verse 3. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. We don't like that, do we? Because that's the point where God says, I can take any pain. I can take any situation. I can take any issue in your life and I can use it for my purposes. And some of us would say, well, I'm not comfortable with that. That doesn't fit into my box of explanations of what I want out of God. And Jesus is going to say, but yeah, it's undeniable, isn't it? And think about your life. Think about the lives of those people around you, whether they're in your workplace or your family, your friends, neighborhood. You have seen, you have experienced time and time again where God is able to use pain, to use difficulty for his purposes. He's done it over and over again. Well, this next verse, I'd be willing to bet Jesus kind of loses his disciples on this one. Verse 4. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. Jesus, we're talking about a blind man here. Why are you always changing the subject? What are you talking about? Well, he goes on to make perhaps one of the most arrogant statements to date. Verse 5. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. In other words, until I came, things have been dark. Things have been confusing. People haven't understood. Nobody has fully understood God. But once I came into the equation, I am the light. If you really want to understand God, if you want to get close to God, if you need to understand that I am the light. I am the way. So unless Jesus is a crazy person, that's a huge statement. If you ever want to understand who God is, it only comes through the person of Jesus. Verse 6. After saying this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. So again, put yourself in the man's shoes for a moment. He's been blind his entire life. He's sitting there minding his own business, and all of a sudden, someone starts putting mud all over his eyes. Wait a minute. And again, if you were God, and you're going to go help a blind man, is that how you would do it? If you were going to heal him, would you spit on the ground? Would you make some mud and get your hands all dirty and get his face all dirty? Of course not. So why does Jesus do that? I mean, there had to have been maybe many reasons why he would do this, but could it be that Jesus wanted to show the man, the people, show us that God operates in ways in our world that don't always fit our box? Verse 7, go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. So again, you've been blind your whole life, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, and all of a sudden you could see for the very first time. I mean, it's a miracle. And so he's kind of going around at this point. Verse 8, his neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg? In other words, they're perplexed at what's going on. Verse 9, some claimed that he was. Others said, no, he only looks like him. So some said, yeah, that's the guy. Others said, no, he just kind of resembles him. That's not really him. But I love what the man says about himself. I am the man. I am the man. John, why are you sharing this story? In verse 10, how then were your eyes open? They asked him. We want an explanation. We need to know how this happened. If you were blind, if you were born blind, and now you're standing before us seeing, we need to know how this took place. We want an explanation. It's a fair question. Verse 11, he replied, the man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash, so I went and washed, and then I could see. You know, that doesn't really work for us. Well, you asked me what happened, I'm telling you what happened, and then they ask a very dumb question, verse 12. Where is this man, they asked him. I don't know, he said. Remember I was blind when he walked away? I mean, I don't know where he went, I just know that he's the man that they call Jesus. So they did what anybody would do in their culture, and oftentimes in ours, when there's a miracle that takes place or something that is unexplainable, they took him to their experts. Verse 13 and 14. They brought him to the Pharisees. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Oh, Jesus, you know better than this. You know by now you can't be doing these types of things on the Sabbath. So verse 15. Therefore the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. He put mud on my eyes, the man replied, and I washed, and now I see. Now you can go back through this and take notice of how many times someone asks this man, how did this happen? The man, again, he tells this unconvincing story to the Pharisees, and maybe you can kind of envision them, well, that just doesn't make sense. Are you kidding me? Now, I think this is relevant for us today because just like the Pharisees, every single one of us, myself included, we have a bit of a God box. And we do. And we want everything about God and about life to fit inside of our God box. And as God moves and acts, there are some things that we just don't reconcile or don't understand. How God works, how God speaks, how what God says, what God does. We want those things to fit inside of our God box. And if we're not careful, we will begin to focus on the things that don't fit inside of our God box, and eventually we might just close the box and throw it away in the corner. That's what happens. Some people even go to the extreme of saying, well, God just doesn't exist. There is no God. God, you're not operating the way that I want to, therefore I'm just going to stop believing in you. That's unexplainable to me. There is no God. That's where some people get to. Now, it's hard for us to understand, but the Pharisees were so focused on this fact that Jesus had healed this man on the Sabbath that that's what had them hung up. Verse 16, some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others asked, how can a sinner perform such signs? So they're divided on this issue. Again, they had to decide, are we going to go with the undeniable or are we going to go with the unexplainable? I think they were so divided, at some point they had to have just kind of thrown up their hands in frustration. Verse 17, then they turned again to the blind man. What have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened. And then the man says, I kind of picture him saying it with a question. Well, he's a prophet, maybe? I mean, maybe that's the explanation. Verse 18, they still did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. So at this point, they don't even believe that this guy standing before them had been born blind. There's got to be some other explanation. Now let me tell you where I see this type of thing happen. I get the privilege of oftentimes being a part of seeing life change happen in someone. And so someone who has had a difficult, maybe even dark past, comes to a point where they accept Jesus as Savior and Lord. They turn towards him. They get baptized. They are all in. And you can see it. Their life is radically changed. And yet family or friends or coworkers will say, wow, I see that they're different, but that can't be Jesus. I see that there's life change that's taken place, but there's got to be some other explanation. I mean, are you taking a class somewhere? Are you on supplements? I mean, there's got to be essential oils. There's got to be something going on here, right? That's what we do. We try and explain it away. There's got to be some other rational explanation. Happens all the time. Verse 19, is this your son, they asked? Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that now he can see? Explain it in a way that we can understand. Verse 20 and 21. We know he's our son, the parents answered, and we know he was born blind, but how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him, he's of age, he can speak for himself, he'll speak for himself. Now, the next few verses, I want you to hear this because we can be guilty of this sometimes as well. Verse 22 and 23. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders who already had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. That was why his parents said, he is of age, ask him. I know that some of you were perhaps raised in a situation that was full of skepticism. Maybe you were raised up in a home where there was difficulty and hurt and pain and you were told time and time again, God is not real. Religion and Christianity, faith, that's a crutch for weak people. Or maybe you experienced a painful situation growing up. Or maybe in recent years something has happened at some point that did not fit in your God box. And so you decided at some point, I don't care what happens. I don't care what I see or what I experience or what goes on around me. Nothing will convince me. God is not real. Or maybe you're convinced that God is not personal or that God doesn't have a plan for your life. And so as a result, your whole life you've kind of been explaining God away and fighting that. But could it be that you're focused so hard on the unexplainable that you've missed the undeniable that's right in front of you. Let's keep going. Verse 24. A second time, they summoned the man who had been blind. Give glory to God by telling the truth, they said. We know this man is a sinner. In other words, one last chance to give us a true explanation of what's been going on, something that fits inside of our God box. Verse 25. He replied, whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know. And I've taught on this before, but this is perhaps the central piece of chapter 9. My favorite part of chapter 9. I was blind, but now I see. I don't understand everything. I don't know exactly what took place. I don't know all the ins and outs, and I can't give you an explanation. But you know what's undeniable? I was blind, and now I can see. I'm standing right in front of you. You asked my parents. You've asked me twice. I'm standing right here in front of you. Verse 26. Then they asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? So they're asking him again, how? You know, sometimes you can focus so much on the how that you miss the who. You lose sight of the who, standing right in front of you. You get so consumed with your unexplainable questions about God or the how things that you're so sure of about God that you miss God entirely in your life. He's right in front of you. He's given you so much evidence, and you just walk right past it. Verse 27, he answered, I've told you already, you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? I'm kind of picturing a jab here. Like, hey, you guys want to follow him as well? Well, next it says that they hurl insults at the man. They throw him out of the synagogue. He can never, ever come back into the synagogue again. He's been kicked out, disfellowshipped. Well, if you read this, the rest of this passage yourself, it says Jesus went, he found the man. He said these words to him, do you believe in the Son of Man? In other words, do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe in me? The man has never seen Jesus before. I'm assuming maybe he recognized his voice in this key moment. Who is he? Tell me so that I can believe in him. I want to believe. I will. And Jesus says, you're looking at him. Verse 38. Then the man said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. Undeniable evidence. The man experienced undeniable evidence. And it was able. He was able to choose that over the unexplainables. You know, every once in a while, someone will ask me, Seth, do you ever have questions that you just can't find an answer for? Do you ever have doubts in life? I'll never forget, maybe it seems later in life to you, but I was in my early 20s. We were down in Mexico and serving there. I had a 17-year-old young man come into our home one evening, and he was just anxious about some things, sat down at our kitchen table and said, Seth, do you ever have doubts? Do you ever have questions about life, about God, about faith? And I'll tell you what I told him that day. Of course I do. Yeah, I do. And I don't want to offend anyone here this morning, but I'm willing to bet I probably have some questions in my God box that would eat your questions for lunch. I've moved along on some questions, no doubt, but I still have huge questions, and they're probably in the same type of category as yours are. When God does not work, when God does not move, when God does not act as I think he ought to or should, or I want him to. And I, as a pastor, I see, well, I get the privilege of oftentimes being right alongside you in the midst of your most joyous, exciting moments. And I also get the responsibility and the privilege of being alongside of you in sometimes the most painful of circumstances as well. And I see and I hear of the pain in your life, and I experience pain in my life and in my family's life, and I ask the same questions. God, why would you do that? Or God, why would you allow that? God, why is this happening? And you know, maybe you have looked up, hey, God, if I were you, you're not, but God, if I were you, I would do things a little bit different. I wouldn't let things happen quite like that. It's difficult because if we're not careful, we can focus on the unexplainable over the undeniable. But let me just encourage you and tell you what helps to calm me and comfort me is when I go back and say, God, I am going to do my best to focus on the undeniable over the unexplainable. You hear me a lot say, remember what you know to be true. Remember what you know is true. I can't explain how you can hit a 90-mile-per-hour fastball. I don't know how you can do it. Somebody can probably explain it, but I can't explain it. But I'm going to choose the undeniable over the unexplainable. Do you know what is undeniable to me? There was a Jewish carpenter who 2,000 years ago showed up in the armpit of Rome, Palestine, with a message that was completely irrelevant to society and culture in the day. Love God, love your neighbor as yourself. And when someone wrongs you, forgive them. Turn the other cheek. In that culture, not ours of course, but in that culture, no way, no how. And yet a few thousand years later, here we are embracing that message, living out that message today. Jesus had the audacity to say out loud, I am God's son. I am the only one who can forgive sins. Are you kidding me? That's what a crazy person would say. And yet again, here we are a few thousand years embracing this message. It's 2019. Do you know why we know it's 2019? Because the world has decided to base our calendar around the birth of this man. Do you know what's undeniable to me? Jesus accomplished so many things that are outrageous. He predicted his own death. He predicted how he would be killed, that he would be crucified, that he would be lifted up. He's confirmed dead. He's buried in a tomb guarded by Roman guards, and on the third day he rose from the grave. Hundreds of witnesses saw Jesus with their own eyes. Do you know what's undeniable to me? Somehow on every continent of the world, in most languages in the world, there are millions of people who would give the exact same story. Jesus has changed my life. Now the explainable is, well, there's surely got to be some handbook out there that's been, you know, passed around for a few thousand years and translated into all these different languages that teaches someone how to fake a conversion story. There's got to be. Because all the stories are, they're so similar. So that's our explanation for that. How is it that so many people, millions of people, share the same conversion story? I also know this. There is a hole in your heart that cannot be filled with people or things. Some of you are trying, perhaps. Some of you who even have enough resources, you're effectively able to change the things, upgrade the things, change the people in your life, and you get to keep replacing things and people over and over again. You've been trying to make a good long run out of it, trying to find satisfaction without a real relationship with God. But at some point, I care who you are, but I don't care who you are. At some point, when you're lying in the still of the night and you're looking up at the ceiling or the stars, you're going to ask the question at some point, what am I missing? This is not working. Life without God is not working for me. Could it be that you have prioritized the unexplainable over the undeniable? You have questions, I have questions. I'm not trying to discount the unexplainables. Some might say, well, what about the Old Testament? There's some dark, crazy, dirty stuff that took place in the Old Testament. There's some tough things in the Bible. How did the world get created? And I can't explain that. You know, on the other hand, do you realize that the best non-religious explanation for the creation of the world is there was nothing, and then a few things collided, and boom, there was something. That's the best thing that non-religious people can come up with. There are questions you have, doubts that you have, things that you will probably wrestle with, struggle with for the rest of your life. But could it be that you're here today because God desperately desires for you to experience life to the full? He has a plan for your life, and His plan is good. So what are you going to do? Are you going to continue to focus on the unexplainable and lose sight of the undeniable? Can you focus in on the undeniable and allow some of the unexplainables to be okay with that? I know that there are some men in the room who are maybe struggling with this idea. And maybe some of you ladies have some uncertainty, some resistance to the undeniables of Jesus. Most men that I know, when we are dealing with some things like this, we tend to get ourselves busy. I'm going to get busy. I'm going to do some things. I'm going to keep myself active. I'm going to try to ignore it. But eventually, every single one of us in the room is going to have to answer that question. Which am I going to focus on? You're not going to get all of your questions about God answered. I promise you that. But I can promise you this as well. If you'll decide to choose the undeniable over the unexplainable, without discounting the unexplainables, if you'll walk down this road with those unexplainables still intact, focusing on the undeniables, they will get answered over time. I've got three takeaways this week, and it's basically targeted at different people in the room. And so the first group of people are these, those who would call themselves a Christian. If you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you have come to faith in Him, you have repented of sin and turned towards God with your life, you've decided, I'm going to be baptized, I'm going to go all in for Jesus. I want to talk to you for just a moment. I have seen strong Christian people drift from their faith because they began to put time and effort and focus in the unexplainable over the undeniable. Something happened in life. Something has rocked their world. And maybe that describes your 2018. It's been a tough year. Here's my simple challenge to you this year. This year, make an effort. Maybe you write this down. I will focus on the undeniable over the unexplainable. Or I will take steps of faith even when I don't understand. I'm going to step into it. I'm going to trust in the undeniable even when it doesn't make sense. Here's group two. Maybe you are not yet a follower of Jesus and you're here this morning. Someone has invited you and you've got questions, and maybe you can relate to the Pharisees in the story, and maybe you would say, well, I'm a little bit of a skeptic right now. I've still got a lot of unanswered questions, and you know, I'm just not quite ready to jump in right now. Since you're here today, I'm thrilled that you're here, but I would challenge you with a very simple prayer over the next several weeks, maybe over the course of this year, however long it takes. God, if you are real, make it clear to me. I want to know you more than I want to know the answers to all my questions. I don't want to miss out on anything you may have in store for me. The third group of people here this morning, maybe you've seen enough. Maybe you've been here long enough, and you've seen enough, and you've heard enough, and you've read enough, and you're at a point where you know what you need to do. You've got family and friends and maybe coworkers who have encouraged you, maybe even prompted you. Friend, what are you waiting for? It's time for you to put the undeniability of God over all your unexplainable questions. For you to jump in. So this is a very simple challenge to you. We have a class that we get people together and we talk about what it is to be a follower of Jesus Christ, how our church is organized, and what our strategy is for ministry here. It's called Starting Point. There are two opportunities for you over the next several weeks. The first one is next Sunday, right after this service at 11:45. The next one is the later part of February. So if this one doesn't work for you, maybe the following does. It's a one-time class. I want to challenge you to be there so that we can converse on a personal level about faith in Jesus Christ, what it means to be a disciple of Him. So if that's you, if you've seen enough, if you're ready and you just need a little bit of a nudge to step over that line, we want to help you with that. We want to help you take that step into faith in Jesus. I don't know where you're at. God knows where you're at. I don't know what you need to do right now, but God knows what you need to do right now. I do know this about every single person here. God has a plan for your life. His plan is good, and it involves you living a life to the full. But at some point, we've got to begin to focus on the undeniable over the unexplainable. Let's pray.